Question here about
practical magic.
Tell me dangerous stuff. This question, is it possible to outline the steps in a practical act of magic? It is possible to do so. Is it possible at this stage, yes? The question of why we should do it is raised, if we do it. All sorts of funny ethical problems are raised, and whether you're really doing anybody a favour by saving them trouble. The question is about, can we outline the steps? So we'll take the outline of the steps first. We've said that the word magic contains the process in the word. M is substance, and you must consider substance individually, universally, and absolutely. That is, that M must represent yourself as a physical being. And draw a little circle for that. And then a bigger one. I'm going to put a cross in that one to remind you that it is a physical body reference. And the bigger one, which is the universal. And another one, which is the absolute. It is three levels of understanding substance. Normally, when you talk about substance in the material world, you are referring to matter. But that is not the way that some philosophers use the word substance. Spinoza, for instance, equates substance and God and makes substance infinite, whereupon he must be talking about this. Remember our sign of Mercury? This unclosed circle, this semicircle, indicates the absolute substance. This closed circle indicates the universal substance, and the little one at the intersection point of two forces is the material substance. Substance is substantia, that which is standing underneath. Now, in the case of the sea, the substance of the sea is all that which is standing underneath the wave forms on the top. But we're still talking, when we're talking about the substance of the sea that we see by the seaside, about matter, about molecules, about tangibles. So substance of the sea there is another word for matter, but it's considered as standing underneath the waveforms. The waveforms create apparent differentiation. And underneath them is a continuous somewhat called substance. In the case of the universal substance, the substance that is being referred to is not tangible to us at the physical level. You cannot, with your physical body, actually strike against universal substance. So this is inaccessible to this. If I move my hand very quickly, I can strike the air and feel it. But the air is already molecular and material in this sense. But the air is a modality, a function of universal substance. And this universal substance, you cannot strike with your physical hand. And beyond the universal substance is the absolute substance. And in the same way that the physical body, your physical face, cannot strike against universal substance, universal substance cannot strike against absolute substance. So if we say that the substance of a material body on Earth is molecular, little atoms are tied together, at the universal level, it is made of something finer than material atoms on Earth. But it is nevertheless a function, an activity. And that activity is circumscribed. Every force in the universe rotates. Now, outside the greatest rotation that we can conceive, the force, which is called spirit, does not rotate, it translates. You see this M form simply continuing all the way. So we have here a concept of substance as underlying universal substance, which underlies gross material substance. Now, in the Bible, it says God is spirit. In the English version, it says God is a spirit. But in the original, there is no indefinite article there, because the ancients didn't use it. They don't say a man, they say man. So you cannot tell from the original document whether you should translate it God is spirit or God is a spirit. And theologians, for their own reasons, in order to produce an object of consciousness, have put in the indefinite article God is a spirit, a equals one spirit. Our non-dualistic training tells us that to say he is one spirit here is untrue. This is one spirit because it is circumscribed. But outside the cosmic circumscription, it is not circumscribed and is therefore not one. Therefore, really, it should not be translated a spirit, but simply spirit. God is spirit. And the moment you say God is spirit, more people will be prepared to accept God than if you say God is a or one spirit. So we have a substance here which is absolute, that is, all the differentiating factors, macrocosmic and particular, are removed, and that absolute substance is the one that we have to operate upon and with in order to produce changes down in the gross world by a technique called magical, the contrary of scientific manipulation. In science, you use a material body to knock another material body to produce a result. You use a material means at a material level. Now, we use the word matter, the substance, plus the Torah, matura, you see, because this Torah means rotation. The concept here of rotation is so big that man's consciousness, which is really placed inside the universe, doesn't see the universe as a big atom. He sees a multiplicity of forms inside it, each one of which is a little being like this, a cross being. So for the gross material body, the universal body is non-material. Nevertheless, it is a rotating body and is therefore a material. But it is a fine matter. So this one we call the gross matter. And this one we call subtle matter. And the top one we call causal. But it is not then called matter. Because when we're considering the cause, we're talking about the point of initiation here. And this sweeps in and then closes. This is the effect of the first order, the big universe, and these are the internal effects, small ones, particulars. The causal one, as far as a man is concerned, is his will. The subtle one is his thought, and the gross one is his body. So we're going to put the will up there and thought here. Ideation, which is form, and here the body moves. And we now have three things to consider. Will formulating, which is ideating, and then condensing and driving up to centers, thus producing gross material tangibles. This is not to be contacted in the same sense that a gross material body is. This can be felt. This you can get hold of by knocking yourself against the resistance. In order to do this one, to gain experience of the subtle, you must contract yourself. You press on yourself. If I strike the board, I am striking something external to myself. If I want to strike in the subtle, I must concentrate my own substance. In order to concentrate it deliberately, I must make an act of will. I must initiate. So if I do contract it deliberately, it follows that I have involved some of the causal, which is spirit. This is soul, and this is body. Spirit, soul, body. Now, we've got to understand what we're doing. This is the same as Jupiter, and this one is the same as Saturn, and the one between is the same as Mercury. The Father is spirit, which is causative intelligence. It comes in, rotates, makes a being, and that rotation is called Mercury. Now that is the messianic Mercury, not the hellish Mercury. And as it's pressing into the center, it is constructing the crucified being in its middle, the gross body. So in this middle zone, the subtle and the soul, is the mediating entity for the Father and the devil. We're now using the Saturn symbol as the ultimate of contraction. Saturn equals Satan, the impression to create a point, and Jupiter as the Father, free, between complete bondage and free spirit, there must be a mediator. That mediator is the mercurial wheel. Now whatever we consider, we have to use symbols in order to build ourselves an organ of thought, and we have to understand precisely what it means to be free. We must be very careful about terms. We must not talk about freedom when we're talking about free. This makes dome subtle, and this one makes the precipitate point within the dome. So to talk about free and dome is to do this. This is free, and this is dome. We must be very, very careful about terms at this level. If we make a single mistake about terms at this level, no matter what we do, and no matter how careful we are, subsequent mental exercises, we must fail to get where we're trying to get. Gurdjieff said on one occasion, if we have an exact language, we can have exact understanding. And without exact language, we can't have exact understanding. So we have here three levels of substance for consideration. One of them is a non-rotating and therefore non-material. That is power. And right at the bottom here, the particular matter, we call that part matter. And between the particular and the absolute is the universal. And the universal takes and presents, actually internal to itself, the spirit, absolute and transcendent, and involves it into the crucified fact of particular material body. Now magic says that we have to become conscious of this absolute causal before we can do it. We must understand M, substance, on the three levels. It's quite useless to think that substance means your gross physical body and then to try to do an act of magic with it. Lots of people have tried it. If one man I know took a feather, he thought that's pretty easy. He put it on the table and said it's only light. So if I have willpower, I should be able to will a feather at least. He thought a ping pong ball was a bit much to start with. And he then began to concentrate with his physical concept on the feather to lift it up. And it didn't lift. It couldn't lift because he had focused on an actual feather, on a table. They were material concepts derived from sense data. So in his mind he was concentrating on the mnemic equivalent of a material datum. It could not work that way. As soon as you concentrate in your mind on the record of a sense datum in that way, you have automatically placed yourself in a wrong brain center to produce the result. Now, Grecian ladies were aware instinctively of where you should place yourself, and they used to do naughty tricks. Sometimes a woman might be having a child, and another woman would think, I don't want her to have that child because I don't like her. So she went and sat on her doorstep and deliberately imaged all the processes of a premature birth, sitting on the doorstep. And the result was there was a premature birth. Because she wasn't doing a man's trick, intellectually defining a material situation. She was actually turbulently inside her own will, grinding herself in. And at the same time, she had a feeling grasp of the person she wished to affect. So she actually conceived that there was no difference between her body and that woman's body in the process. So when she contracted her own tissue, she felt, not thought, she felt, this tissue which I am contracting is the woman's tissue that I am acting upon. So she wasn't a dualist. That is why the woman is generally a good magician, and if she were trained, I'm glad there are no presents of mine. If she were trained, she could be a bigger nuisance than she is. She actually does it now, but she cannot believe it, because she hasn't got a formal conceptual reference stable enough to refer to all the time. So when she does it, she might sit in a chair and construct a horrible mood, and she may drag the whole atmosphere of a room down until the poor male becomes irritated and rushes about. It's magic. If she knew she could do it, she'd do it more. Luckily, nobody ever tells her this. In any case, if you tell her intellectually, she couldn't believe it. But she could be encouraged by feeling processes to develop it. Remember, a woman is a more undifferentiated. And the original more is the absolute. We have three levels of more, right? We have substance. This substance is not to be considered as a matter insentient. The substance of the absolute is sentient. It is a feeling intelligent power. When it feels, it can contract or expand or direct itself. And it is a more. Shakespeare called it universal wolf. That universal wolf, that's the eater, makes meat, there's meat, and there's the tea in it. The riddle of Samson again. Remember? Out of the eater came forth the meat. Out of the absolute will comes forth every form that there is, down to the tiniest and grossest material atom. So, we should remind ourselves what we're talking about. Practical magic, yeah. Practical magic is pyrarchical magic, which means rationally determined. You set yourself up a purpose rationally beforehand. First you define what you want to produce. We'll discuss the ethics of it later. First you define rationally what you want to produce. And once you have defined it, in order to produce it, you must then get off the rational plane. Remember, this level is the causal. And it is only this circumscribed level that is rational. The pyrar is the same thing in the pyrarchical way. That is the same thing as the rational. So when we have defined it rationally, we must get off the rational plane, and we must do that terrible act called exaltation of the will.
Now, exaltation of the will is well known to ladies in the function called N2, and it consists of working yourself up in the will. Do you know how to work yourself up? You really need it. It's not very easy for boys. You actually have to emote and turbulate your emotions and build up entirely by act of will. It can't be done any other way.
And you then make a center of yourself, and you are turning on your will, and you are trying to drive into your own center. Now, this is the same thing that we mentioned before in the generation of light for individuals. We must have a saturnine compression. We must drive onto the center. And remember, we are not being intellectual now, we finish with definition. We must drive onto the center by act of will. Our definition is completed, we know what it is, and we're not concerned with it anymore because it has been set. We then drive that Saturn as hard as we can onto the center, and it must hurt. If it doesn't hurt, it isn't going to be magic. If you don't concentrate to the point of I'm getting a bit hot myself, getting hot. You must get hot. And you must drive yourself till that heat. Remember, heat is motion, kinetic theory of heat, quite useful. It is motion you are driving into the center. And you are a finite structure, as a man. You are going to drive energy into your center and compact it and keep driving it until it bursts. Now that burst is called ejaculation, isn't it? The out. Throwing out, ejecting. And you cannot eject at the absolute level unless you drive in from the gross material into the cosmic and force the cosmic to flow that way. It cannot be done any other way, which means you have a terrific amount of energy. You may have seen a baby sometimes go into a sort of cataleptic condition to defeat the parents. I don't know whether you have actually seen a child become rigid with this will, because it's going to beat its parents. When it does so, you can pick it up by the ankles when it's in that stiff condition, and it won't bend. Now, that is the kind of will you've got to have. A hysterical woman does the same thing. She will form an arch, and if you like, very quickly, before she has time to change her mind, you can put her in variety theatre and break a large block of stone on the stomach and get paid for it. Because she's very, very rigid. That rigidity is the kind of thing that's wanted. There's a funny disease ladies sometimes have under very distressing emotional conditions, eclampsia. In eclampsia, they actually strike a light. And the light that they are striking is the same kind of light that's in here. And they do it for definite emotional reasons. It's called a disease because it upsets the gentleman who have to attend to it, as well as the lady who's doing it. The point is, we must drive in to a center up to the point that we produce the martial flash. There's your symbol. That arrow coming out to the sign of the planet Mars. Now, that is what you've got to get. That is the sign of ejaculation. The sign for Venus is rather humorous because it says, now I have crucified you. See, you shoot at me, and then I put you on the cross. That's a lady, that's a gentleman. Venus represents your own substance, as well as somebody else's. You have to reach flashpoint, and when you do so, the flash doesn't come out at the gross material level, it doesn't come out at the subtle level of idea. It comes out at the absolute causal level and causes big ripple through the absolute substance. And then the character of that ripple is determined by the prior definition that you made. So that ripple has a certain resonance beat on it. And then the beam you intended to operate on here has already that resonance beat in it.
so that your magical wave will resonate at the beat of that beam. You can then understand why people collect bits of nail parings and hair as resonance points upon which to act. And they're quite helpful. You don't actually need them, but they do help to focus the mind in the first case to give you the necessary impetus. But there is a definite resonance between those and the person that drew them. So that shortly is an outline of the actual magical process. We'll state it again that you have to have concept of the three substances. You must know that you're wasting your time furrowing your eyebrows and scowling of the gross material muscle. It doesn't help. You must climb through the subtle, formal, definitional liking and disliking level. And you must compress yourself until the force in you ejaculates into the causal level. Whereupon the prior definition is the resonance factor that will determine that the ripple you release will go to where it should go. Now it requires a lot of energy. We'll consider whether it's a good thing to do it at all now in relation to another part of the question. Supposing we consider as individuals that some other being needs help. Now, we must also remember another thing. Every being has come on earth for the express purpose of learning what it means to be a human being. We come here to learn, and we've got no time for anything else. Carlyle, on one occasion, Richard Carlyle, said, "I want to say either I must learn or I must teach. I must learn from somebody who knows more than I do, or teach somebody who knows less. And I have no other purpose." So we are going to consider now whether we should act on another person who is learning. If we tried to save them trouble of a certain kind, we would actually do them a profound disservice, because they've only got so much time. And if we save them trouble now, they are retarding their evolution. You know that as a physical fact. In the case of parents, sometimes with an only child, and they indulge it and save it all sorts of troubles, and the child is then lacking in fiber when it grows up. They've done no service. We'll consider the spiritual aspect of this in the highest sense. Remember, the moral is the expedient for the ruling class. The ethical is what rational human beings do to each other. So we're not concerned with the moral or the ethical. We are concerned with spiritual value, evolutionary value. The question is, if a given individual is at a certain level, is there any use in a magical practice to act on that individual? And the answer is there is. If that individual genuinely cannot help himself, and our justification point is not moral or ethical, but absolute. The absolute spirit has precipitated a man. The absolute spirit has precipitated another man. This man may have worked. He's a fairly integrated fellow. This man may have worked not quite so far, maybe younger, either in years or biologically. Some people have more ancestors than others. And this being could act upon that being. This being is striving to get to this level. If he could get to this level without assistance, he should be allowed to. But very, very often with human beings, they can get lost, because there are external stimulus situations. He might be just about to see the light, and four friends coming with him into a pub and stuffing with alcohol, and cart him off for the next 30 years. In which case, he's wasting a lot of his time. It happens. So, there is a spiritual justification of a magical act. And we are not concerned with the moral and the ethical implication, because they're of a lower order than the spiritual. Now, we've given a little outline of the magical practice itself, and we've said here that, subject to one condition, the being must have been blocked by something, frustrated, so that he cannot get out himself.
And when that has occurred, it is spiritually justified
and spiritually necessary
that he should be helped.
If we didn't get helped, we'd be blocked completely.
If Christ hadn't been crucified, millions of people would have been blocked today.
If Buddha had not come, millions of Indians would not have been helped. If Lao Tse, I won't mention Confucius.
But each person who has integrated to a certain level knows that it is his duty. And duty is what God crucifies himself in order to integrate for.
There's your real meaning of duty.
This is a contraction of God crucified for integration. Every time there is a being who, moving towards integration, has been blocked by external stimuli, naughty Apollyon blocking Christian, and so on, assistance is needed, and to the one receiving it, it is grace, because he could not get it himself. To the one giving it, as he has received it from the Absolute, he knows it was once grace to him, although now to him it is an act of will. But as Christ says, freely have you received, freely give. If having received, like a certain gentleman in one of the parables in the Bible, he received the forgiveness of a debt, and then he decided he wouldn't forgive another man his debt, he was still wrong. If you receive freely, well, then give freely, because if you don't, you will close the door. If you close that door in yourself, you will demote yourself and you will go backwards and become a square, as they call them these days. And there is the process, and that is the spiritual justification of magical interference. Now, have we got any points in need clarification about this magical process?
In that first part, where what you describe as a magical process could almost be identical, well, it appears identical to me, to the psychological diagram that you had, in which you placed down under the planetary, so within, placed on it the planets. So there's an actual fact, your act of integration is a magical process of grace, isn't it?
Yes, yes. You cannot integrate yourself without that magical process.
Let's look at that. It's tremendously important. If we do not contract and set it, we cannot gather to us the scattered elements of being. We have so many cells in our body. If we lose our principle of unity, our will to live, to exist, we begin to disintegrate. When we have gathered together various things, suppose we go to school and we learn reading, writing, and arithmetic. Now, those three have got to be coordinated somehow. They cannot be coordinated at the intellectual level. It is impossible. If we take reading, a visual stimulus, and writing, which is a motor activity, there is no logical ground for putting them together. If we take the mathematical processes of adding one and one and one, there is no logical ground for putting that with reading or with writing. So that at the intellectual, the logical level, we have no possibility of unifying those three functions. Now the only thing that can unify them is a reduction of them all back into the primal fire. Only fire fuses. That's the magical rule. So we have to drive reading back and writing and arithmetic back to their ultimate. And their ultimate is fire, and that fire is desire, and that desire is absolute magic. I put 3 R's down there. Reading is a process of differentiating at the visual level. Writing is a process of differentiating at the motor level. And arithmetic is a process of differentiation
at the intellectual level, purely atomic. They're all differentiation processes. So there's a point of unity there. We then have to make that fuse together and see exactly why, when we are reading arithmetic. And we're really writing, because if a child is not taught to write, to make a B and a D and so on, he can't read. Because actually what you look for is the objectification of a motor process that you have acquired. And in order to do that, you require certain numbers of nervous impulses to add up arithmetically to make that motor movement possible and that visual reception of the result of it possible. So it pushes us back to a primary act of will. When we take those, even if you cannot now see all the implications of it, if you took this as your first magical exercise rather than operating on another shuttle, just to see what happens, just say, let's put it down, there is an R there, and there is another one there, and there should be another one there, shouldn't there? Looks like the legs are there, put them all together now. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. Now there's reading, writing, and arithmetic, three processes of differentiating. Now here's an exercise for you. Don't try and do this intellectually. Put those three R's like that in a circle in your mind. Tell yourself one represents reading, the other writing, the other arithmetic. And after you've done that, don't be concerned anymore to intellectualize it. If you do, you will stop the magical sound. You then take this thing and you deliberately imagine that circle to go smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller until you cannot differentiate those three R's. Now they'll start trying to bounce out. In other words, you start falling back onto the intellectual plane. Careful. You'll start remembering that you put three R's in there. That's intellectual activity. You mustn't do it. You must contract that circle onto a point. You know, single pointedness is the rule. To do it, you will need terrific energy. Hold those three and make them into a point and do not let them bounce out. And then try to reduce by act of will that point and make it invisible. Smaller and smaller, and you mustn't allow any energy to bob out and say, what I put inside there was three R's. If you do, you've leaked. If you drive the energy into the center and reduce that point until it disappears, at that moment, the energy you've expended will be more than you can now imagine. At that moment, there will suddenly be a flash in your mind, and you will understand precisely how those three are not three, but one. And that is a magical process. And from the moment you've done it, to you, to see that will be to be presented simultaneously with a highly complex and heterogeneous structure, but to you it will be simple. Simple means seed, fold. Simple is seed, fold. The simple is all the potentials folded into that point. Now, it cannot be done any other way. And there's a good way for you to begin. When you've done that, take any other things that don't fit in your mind. Just say that they don't fit, and then drive them together by act of will. And force them together. You can't do it any other way. This is called taking the kingdom of heaven by violence or by storm. It's the only way an individual can do it, with individual will. The other way is to let go of the individuality completely, in which case you lapse back, if you are successful in letting go, into nirvana, the absolute negation of the individuality. But in the magical process, we retain the individuality and use the individual will in order to force into a fused state heterogeneous elements. The average person cannot do it. Dare not do it. Dare not contemplate it. Dare not contemplate the process, in fact, because the moment he were presented really seriously with the idea of the possibility, he would panic. Because you see, he's so afraid of his own intention that he cannot trust anybody else's. He says if he were magical, he would do tremendous things. Therefore, if anybody is magical, they must already have done tremendous things to him. So his fear stops him operating. And this you can find inside yourself in your initial exercises, that at the precise moment you get near to the point where you're beginning to believe that you're going to do it, a shake will appear. Now, remember we said, when you make the contraction, it hurts. When the hurting comes, there is a flight, represented by Jupiter. There's the contraction. And here's a flight from the compunction center. The moment you feel that flight, your purpose, as defined by you, will try to catch that flying energy and bring it back in. That generates the mercurial wheel. And that mercurial wheel, continuously held in by the saturnine will to compress it, and continuously trying to fly because it's painful in the center, develops this terrible vibrating and jitter. The nearest thing you can have for an average man's experience of this is the sexual fact of ejaculation, where there's actually a process of jittering goes on inside in the same manner before the flesh. The process is running.
How would you describe the emotional state before that flash? Would you describe it as a subtle ecstasy? Or?
Well, it's obviously got the identity of opposites in it, because you've got the power, death, of the contraction there, the grip of death, and the freedom of the absolute simultaneously. So there is a simultaneous joy there, and a terrible death pain there. The same thing happens actually in ejaculation. There is a pang plus a realization of freedom. It's very, very complex. It bothers the psychologists a lot because it is very hard to analyze it.
Well, really speaking, you can actually feel great sorrow rising in your tantrum.
Oh, yes.
Is that of the same nature?
It's of the same nature, yes. But you've got to drive this until you experience both at once. And this is where the work done by Adam, the splitting of good and evil, is reversed. The good and evil are fused. This is the good, Jupiter, and that's the evil, Saturn. You fuse them together and make Mercury, a wheel of light, a beam of light. Remember, there's only the one process, and this process is the magical process. So we have to take our substance, lift it up to the absolute level by energy application. We have to concentrate it in the grip of death, that hard gamma there is saturnine. We have right in the middle of it the final point, which has got depressed upon and made to disappear into the absolute as a pure force propagation, and then the controlling factor which we have involved in this and which is going to give the kick to the whole continuum of the absolute.
K is the absolute flash, then that's the K.
Yes.
If this is the basis of some of the then.
We have to be very careful about this. It is exactly the opposite. It's exactly the opposite of what you do in Zen. In Zen, you simply define what is going to happen, and you then wait for it. And the thing is going to break through you. Zen is the end result of the Buddhist process of the negation of the individual. So, in the case of Zen, we take this principle, Saturn, and we... equal and opposite, and therefore they require exactly the same amount of will. So it's just as hard to inhibit the individuality and wait for that Zen expression, saying Zen archery or something like that, you're waiting for a moment of expression through you. To inhibit the interference requires as much energy as it does to drive onto the center with your own will, because they're equal and opposite. One is as hard as the other. And it's a question entirely of temperament, the difference between East and West. Which one is down? Both processes are worth experimenting with, because then you'll find out your own particular bias. Some people are Orientalists at heart, because they've got an Oriental heritage. You can see in the different bone formations of the people that you see around you, different racial characteristics. And they have brought with them their racial psyche. And they have a bias towards introverted or extroverted techniques. In your own case, you can find out which is the easier method for you. But you should try both. And ideally, you should be able to do both. Just in the same way that the East and the West today are being forced to fuse two opposite techniques. The East is becoming highly mechanized, and the West is becoming highly philosophic and metaphysical. Ideally, you should be able to do everything. But initially, you may have to go with the method suitable for you first. And you have to decide by experiment whether it's easier for you to cut down on egotism or to contract the egotism to its term and burst through. That you will know in actual experimental work.
This whole process is a resonance process.
Resonance is the mechanics of it, but not the cause of it. The cause of it is will.
That's what I wanted to ask you, at what point does this resonance start? Is it up to universal, or is there a resonance, an absolute resonance?
There is an absolute resonance. Remember what we said about the Aleph, which represents the absolute? That letter symbolizes the kind of vibration. The Chinese version of it is the Tai Chi. In every resonance, there are two impulse points meeting against each other and creating a firmament, a barrier between them. And that is made to vibrate by those impulse points. And the vibrations are very, very simply keyed in. If I do a vibration like that and another one like this, well then, these don't fit. But if I go on repeating this and this, at some point they will actually coincide. And where they coincide, there is a movement of power from one frequency to another. If we say this is a length of string on an instrument, if the whole of it is made to vibrate, then half of it vibrates. So it's singing the octave above. And the half of a half is vibrating, so it's two octaves above, and so on. Also, a third of it is vibrating, which gives you the so-called dominant, and the octave above it, and so on. And also, half of a third is vibrating, sixth. So when the whole string vibrates, every note in the universe vibrates with it. But the one that you hear most easily, we call the fundamental of that string. Nevertheless, that's a legitimate diagram of the universe, the full width of it. You can put the stars there, and you can say, here is a solar system, and someone's planetary systems, and so on, inside. The macrocosmic sphere has a diameter, which is its fundamental tone, and the subdivisions of that are internal systems. And subdivisions of those go right down to subatomic particles, all of which are simple subdivisions of the original fundamental. And that fundamental is the unifying factor of it, that continuum. So the resonance is a question there, mechanical. If we know a man's name is this vibration, and we send out a vibration like this, it won't have much effect on him, because very rarely will there be a coincidence of a wave crest or drop. If we know his resonance, and we send another one out like him, it will affect him very profoundly.
Remember, there is no force we can release that has no effect whatever, because being a resonance, it must fit somewhere, propagated far enough. But only where the fittingness recurs at regular intervals in a short enough space of time is there sufficient influence to justify doing it.
When you talk about this high energy level necessary, I take it that automatically is going to eliminate a large number of people, is it? A lot of people
have
that high energy level.
Straight away. You see, we know for a fact that man, 150,000 years ago, had quite a large capacity in the head. And we also know that there has been a steady degeneration of masses of people. There were very, very few to begin with. Absolutely one mutant, polarized and split. Now the energy involved in that being is split out over a very, very large area. And that energy spread out over a large area means that people are getting weaker and weaker as individuals. So that when we come down to a period like today, democratic, we know that the energy is spread out over a very, very large area, and therefore, in the individual, it is hard to get hold of. There's too much consideration for what other people would think to begin with. That's herd instinct dominating over the individual, because the individual original cell, we call the Adamic cell, has split its energy out over millions of people.
That's what you're actually doing in integration, is gathering up all that energy.
You're actually robbing other people. And they don't mind. They're like the produce in Animal Farm in 1984. They don't want to gather themselves together because there's a certain kind of pleasure in leaking. The real pleasure in leaking. And the cause of that real pleasure in leaking is a macrocosmic need for precisely that. There is a suction going on all the time. Remember, to every action there's an equal and opposite reaction. The universe exists as a gross material entity. Therefore, there has been a contraction. Therefore, there is a contrary equal expansion. Now it's this expansion that is pulling all the time, robbing that centre of energy. So that millions of people are actually being robbed by this energy. It's being played back to cause the evolution of worlds other than this earth, and will eventually be used for that purpose. Meanwhile, there is a need on the earth for some few people to organize that process on earth. An organization requires concentration of energy. You can't organize without concentration. So there is a need for a few, and because there is a need for a few can do it. But that few in the process are taking energy, and the many are spreading it out, and the many want to lose it because it's pleasurable to leak. So you have to decide whether you want to be a leaker or not. See, all the way along the line in this magical process, you are required to make decisions. What am I? Am I a leaker or a concentrator? Am I a man of the people, going to spread myself out, or am I trying to become a reciprocal point for a purpose other than the merely splurge purpose of supplying certain manures for future civilizations? Because millions of people who die today are actually manuring future civilizations. Just in the same way that the earth itself has been changed chemically by the growth of the great vegetative periods and then the great periods of the Saurians, all the primitive animals, they've all lived and died, and the earth has been changed. And out of that changed chemistry appeared the mutant man. And nevertheless, the ordinary low-level one is manure for a higher man, and he for the highest. This is what Nietzsche is talking about. Somewhere there is an ideal, and some few men can reach it. But if we take this, that there's a definite amount in any closed system of energy of a given vibration, there's only one fundamental across here, isn't there, in any direction, until we fill it up, and all the rest is sub-level vibration, and weaker. There's a definite amount of intelligence available. It's got to be gathered together in some few centres, and to gather it together you have to take it off others. And this is not a democratic thought, but it's what Christ said: unto him that hath, unto him shall be given, unto him that hath not, even that which he hath shall be taken away. If you've got a little bit of concentration and you use it, you'll get more. If you don't, the bit you have will be taken away. That's what Jesus says, and that's fighting talk. You cannot stand still. Somebody is robbing you, or you're robbing somebody in understanding.
Is that very real situation, working in a very rigid manner all the time? And you say that the few, and only a few, you need a large number of few, and only able to reach that objective.
You mean predetermined? Do you mean a predetermined number?
Yes, by determined by the quantity of energy that exists that they can.
Now, this is the question of Calvinism, isn't it, and predestination. According to the Calvinists, you are either saved or not already by God's fiat. And if you're not saved, there's nothing you can do about it. And so either you're a Calvinist and saved, or you're not saved. Now, let's look at it very carefully. There is a finite amount of energy available, and there's a finite number of people, and the energy is spread out over all the people equally. Would mean no hierarchy, no orders, no organization, because organization implies hierarchy, and that some have more power than others. Now, when a given man gets a bit of power, so as he ascends, he drags himself up and draws in energy and makes himself a mountain like this, then if he remembers the law and the purpose for which he has been dragged together, namely proper organization of the world, he is all right. But historically we know for a fact that the men who have dragged themselves up there, very, very often, apart from half a dozen, once they've been up there, they have relaxed. And they have stopped organizing in the way the absolute wants it, and have tried to stabilize a social organization material, like Napoleon wanted to do. They climb on this great law, and when they get up, they're so pleased with themselves instead of the absolute, they try to stabilize an environment in their own name. And when they do so, they start to perish. Because this definition of their society is a financing factor, and itself can only take so much energy. So in defining that situation, he has limited his ascent possibility. Now, immediately outside here, it's a smaller one who, because this fellow has made a definition which doesn't include this man, that man can begin to grow outside this man's definition. And he can, if he's that clever, profit by this man's error. And he can start to grow, and he can take available energy from lazy leakies and build himself up with no definition whatever. So if he starts drawing from an infinite distance, and he's not restrained by this finite definition, so he can actually integrate to a higher level than that socially crucified person.
You have the And it describes the difference between the non-dualism and the monastic technique.
Yes. If we take a prime minister, he has actually crucified himself and limited his energy absorption by defining himself as a prime minister. And the being is actually called the powers behind the throne, never hit the headlines. And they are not defined as prime ministers and other things, because they're too busy wandering about the world, stuffing little gentlemen into prime minister's positions. And the more they can persuade a man to accept a definition as worthwhile and work within it, the more free they become, because they've committed him to a definition. Now the Tao Te Ching hints at it in saying, he who does not declare his aim cannot be said to fail. And declaring the aim is the same thing as finiting yourself as a definition.
Another thing I would like to ask, when you described Napoleon as having become satisfied with the empire he built for himself, the moment he did that, could you describe that as closing the door on grace?
Of course, yes, certainly.
That's what he does to himself,
yes.
At the moment he begins.
Yes.
And that is the play of your own hair that Samson was,
yes,
concerned,
yes,
with.
When he defined his child before evidence as a child of capacity, a king, he had already sealed himself as not the man he was when he started. He finited the process and said, from now on it comes through my line, even without merit. And when he began to get fat and became a subject matter for medical research into his decline, and something fell, it's a sort of glandular disorder that got hold of him, that was an effect. He had accreted a certain amount of energy to himself, and this energy he threw out into the environment to push his limits farther and farther. And then at a certain point, although he got the door open for colossal energies, he made a definition and sat down. The energy inertias that had been coming through him then pushed to the limit and were reflected back onto him, and he started fattening up. Because now he was conserving, not giving. Now this can happen to anybody.
Did Nietzsche completely understand this principle? Because he called his superman the Antichrist.
Well, it's quite obvious that Nietzsche did not manage to integrate himself, because he broke down mentally. And if you remember his origin and the difficulties he had with churchmen in the family, he had a misconception of the nature of Christ, because he said Christ died too early. If he'd have lived a bit longer, he would have had more sense. Which shows that he did not understand the fundamental principle. But he gathered from reading the ancients that there were two forces in the world: the Apollonian force, the force of Apollo, order, definition, and the Dionysian force, which crashes through all definitions. And he saw society as hidebound with definitions, and he knew by the nature of definition that the absolute force is working into it. The funny thing is, if you get a box and seal it up so that it's dark inside, the cosmic radiation forces will go inside and start working in it. Effectively start to work it. There's a funny box you can make where you see lights appearing in it if you keep it in the dark. And this force going in changes its phase and then starts hammering against the walls until it breaks them. Now that definition is Apollo. Apollo is the god of order. And the Dionysian figure is the Christ figure of the early Greek myth. He breaks through the walls because he is that energy that's come from the absolute, not accepting the definition. Nietzsche, in studying Greek tragedy, discovered this principle. And he looked around in modern society and he saw modern society was hidebound with definitions. Therefore he confidently predicted war upon war upon war. Because he knew the absolute was trying to create a being absolute like itself. A being that could act absolutely. That is not with intellectual petty considerations,
for the materialistic utilitarian values of the world. Being acts without regard to those is called absolute action. He knew that was a possibility, and he knew that nobody was acting absolutely. And he knew that that absolute force must come in and break it out. So he predicted that there would be explosion and explosion and explosion. Nevertheless, he was not able to assimilate it in his own organism. It blew his organism to bits. Because he himself was a definition. His mind had been built by the members of his family, churchmen and so on, with concepts. And in inducing this Dionysian force into himself and aiming it at other people, he was invoking more of this force. This is a magical process again. He was invoking this force in order to hit at other people. In the process, it hit at the conceptual structures inside himself and broke them to bits. He was born in Nebo, which made it difficult for him to coordinate those in any case. And he was terrifically learned over a very, very wide field, so he had a colossal number of entities that needed holding together. And yet he was a 19th century man when the magical process itself was in disrepute. The few magicians who were working in Europe at that time didn't write books on it. They were very, very busy seeing that they personally didn't get blown to bits by identifying with the absolute and dissociating from the conceptual structure that tradition had put upon them. You'll notice that if ever you find fear in yourself, it is always fear about some particular that is being hit at in you. If you were nothing, you couldn't fear. Fear is again fear, it's reasoning. If you've got any particular thing in you that can be hit at by a stimulus, then you fear it. Whereas if you know that form itself is circumscription, and that that circumscription is an effect of an absolute force, and you identify with the absolute, you cannot be afraid of the disruption of the definitional system. So that you don't care if somebody proves you wrong in every particular idea you've got. Because you say, well, I'm not a man of my ideas. So I'll give you another one, prove that one. And you bring them all up. And the more the other fellow will prove you wrong, the freer you are. Nevertheless, there is a certain amount of inertia there. And if you deliberately expose yourself to criticism in order to break down an idea, you will feel a bit depressed when somebody actually breaks one down. But if you remember the rule, the observer is not the observed, and the observer is absolute, and you identify with the absolute, the depression will be centered in the physical body and seen as an object. And it will go very quickly. Whereas if you think that you are being proved wrong, you will identify with it. As it disrupts, you also will disrupt. Actually, it's getting very, very near the time, and we've been doing so much work here that it would be good for those people here who dare to expose their ideas to be hit at.
You mean to talk to other people and to
actually to bring an idea out, a cherished one, it's got to be something you really believe to be true, and set it up there, and the person who does it will advance very quickly. Dare to put an idea in the middle and challenge everyone in the room to hit at it. This incidentally is a Jesuitical exercise, where a person has to deliberately take a position and everyone else in the school hits at that and smashes it. It's designed as an exercise to break egotism. Have we got any offers? Any courageous young man with a cherished idea? Person who dares to do it first will move most quickly.
I don't like to think that something in me will perish utterly in death. I can't quite define what that something is. I think it might be my soul.
Did everybody get the definition, huh? Now we want some points to to prove that he must perish utterly. Can anybody think of a logical reason why he must perish utterly? Because for his sake now, we've got to prove him wrong. This is the exercise. We must search our minds, not to say that we don't believe that you will really perish utterly. Yeah. We must prove to you that there's nothing in you worth persisting. That you really are a perisher. We have to prove that. Now can we have some offers? That's very, very good. The mere fact that you have the fear means that you could perish. So that you should really be afraid of the fear of disintegration. Shouldn't you?
I wonder if I'm really afraid or just that I don't like it.
Not liking it is just a mild way of saying I am afraid. Because liking has to do with that which is like, that which can be assimilated. And assimilation is integration. And the opposite, dissimilation, is disintegration. And if you like it, it means you want to integrate. So if you say you do not like the idea, it means that you're afraid of its opposite. You dislike the idea that you cannot assimilate, therefore you must disintegrate.
I've heard of the police girl Nirvana. It doesn't altogether suit me.
Can we have any more attacks on this?
Well, the mere fact that the fear exists means that a certain ideational process has taken place without there being an actual situation there. So that's mechanicalness.
Yes.
And at the mechanical level, you're subject to the karmic path,
yeah,
which is going to take you out completely. Could I describe it as the Petriana path?
Yes, but even there, he would persist in some degree.
Persist to some degree.
Yeah. Can we find any stronger one? A real attack to prove that it's quite impossible for death to survive. Can you find anything at all? Can anyone find the reason why you should completely disintegrate? Apart from the fact that if he does, nobody will care.
Well, not too valuable
particularly disintegrate. If there is an entire, there can't be anything else.
Just a moment, you're making out a case that may turn into the opposite one. I want you to make that gentleman in the he's afraid of disintegrating. I want you to make him more afraid, not less.
Not really more afraid.
More afraid. Find a way of shaking him and convincing him that really he must disintegrate. You haven't been kind-hearted tonight.
He has this fear. It must be because presumably he doesn't know himself fully. Presumably he can never know himself fully, therefore he must remain in this state.
Yeah, that's very good, because it's a long job. You are required, in order to avoid this disintegration which you fear, to gain absolute knowledge. But that which fears is necessarily finite, and the finite can never gain absolute knowledge, therefore it must disintegrate.
He's just a little knot of some substance that has been knotted and one day will just be unknotted and cease to be.
And he didn't tie the knot himself, and therefore he cannot stop it being untied. How are you feeling?
Quite as good as I did.
You're afraid of that you're disintegrating. You don't like the idea. Well, you attach a great importance to yourself. You think you shouldn't do it.
fine attach a certain color to some stuff, yes.
Well, you take the infinite, the universe, compared to the infinite, the solar system compared to the universe, the world compared to the solar system, the individual compared, doesn't it reduce your value in your own? Are you so important?
I think I have a certain importance to myself, to anybody else possibly. It's not that I'm so concerned about importance, it's something I'm going to call identity, like that.
Isn't it just ego?
Identity.
Now, would anybody like to have a snack at identity? What is it?
Well, that is the cardinal sin, isn't it? But it is sin, the identification of yourself.
Separation.
Well, that's identity. You are identifying yourself. You're separating yourself from any other individual or thing. Right. So you're separating yourself from the infinite.
Have you got a governing concept which you're identified with, which you consider worthy of continuing? Could you say something about that?
Glasses left. It's a question of the persistence of an identity which is independent. Because you said take away the form. So there's an undefinable identity. And you know very well that the term indefinable and identity are contradictory terms, aren't they? You can't have an identity without a form, can you?
True.
Well then, what is this mysterious non-identity that you want to preserve? Because if it's an identity, it's a form, and you said it was formless.
Something that's going to come back in another reincarnation and have a better time, I think.
But without continuity of consciousness, which means a constant formal reference, whether you come back or not is a matter of no importance to you. Because if you don't know that it's you who's come back, then it's meaningless.
But it's possible to have that continuity of consciousness because you taught us how to do it.
Only by reference to an unbreakable concept, which is a reference. And that is a form. You have the formula, the observer is not the observed, and that is a form. It's a formula.
Yes.
Now, can you see how close we're getting to the real thing? And consider very, very carefully, are you really afraid of the loss of that formless non-identity, which might at some point occur?
No, if it has no form, I can't be afraid of losing it. I agree with that, because it's unrecognizable.
Mm-hmm. So it's a form that you're afraid of losing?
I agree with that, yes.
Mm. Now, do you know which particular form it is?
once upon a time you were a baby running about in London. And you changed your form, and there was something at the back that was you all the time, wasn't there? And when you're a very old man on all fours again, there'll still be the same thing, this continuity principle running through. What is it? It must be a form, otherwise we cannot differentiate it from the same in all us.
That's because the people who knew me when I was 10, if they still know me when I'm 80, I'm still here, they will still know me as Jack.
Yes.
Something like that.
What is it?
I don't really know.
Well, can you be afraid of it? Of its disappearance? It cannot be any bodily form, because that has changed all the way. It can't be a mental form, because when you were a child, before you were educated, you didn't have any mental form in the sense that we're discussing. You simply had a will impulse and some pleasure-pain reactions.
A little point of consciousness.
It's a point of consciousness. Now, what is the source of that point of consciousness?
I should say the absolute.
The absolute. Can the absolute in any sense lose any of itself?
No.
Is that point that you're referring to part of the absolute?
Yes.
Can it be lost?
No.
Can you still be afraid of losing it?
No, I couldn't be afraid of losing it.
How do you feel that? Well, this exercise is a very good exercise, because if you dare to expose yourself and open yourself to attack, the other fellow will supply you with the energy without which you can't work it out. With all the people here, if they'd all spoken, they would have been working for you. If they had. They didn't. Perhaps they didn't want to work for you. Whatever the cause, they didn't actually work for you, and therefore you had to do a bit of thinking yourself. Now, the more often you can set yourself up as a target and expose your ideas to the most argumentative types you can find, the more work will be done in your mind by their words, and you can watch and sort them out. And you'll come down to a process. We actually handed up the last process to the fact that that point to which you refer when you say something you feel should continue is actually eternal and indestructible. And if there is any fear, it cannot refer to that. It can only refer to that with which you are falsely identified.
That's what I meant originally, I think.
Well, now you're a bit more clear about it.